ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, they say there are two certainties in life, death and taxes. But what if we could make one of those uncertainties, or certainties uncertain? I'm not talking about dodging taxes. I'm talking about avoiding death. It's something we've sought for all of human history, eternal life. Might seem fanciful, but some scientists speculate we could potentially surpass previous human lifespans and postpone the inevitability of death through groundbreaking life extension science. This morning on Overnights, we're talking to Dr. Aubrey de Grey. He's a scientist who's dedicated himself to the science of life extension, and he's president of the chief science officer of the Longevity Escape Velocity Foundation, a not-for-profit initiative that researches the field of biogerontology. He joins us on the line. G'day, Doctor.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on the show.
And of course, we should mention you're joining us all the way from the US, which is very good of you. It's 11 o'clock in the morning, not 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. Hey, how did you get into this? How did you get into this field? Because I know when I was a kid, you know, that sort of that time you remember you were confronted with your own mortality. You realized you were going to die, and the reason you remember it is because it is confronting. Can you remember that moment?
Not exactly. Let me give a little bit of a background to my answer. First of all, let me talk about taxes, because it is an interesting fact that a very disproportionate number of the people who are strong supporters of this movement and who have helped me to do research over the years are libertarians, who are very much focused on the taxes part of the equation, as you mentioned it. But also about death. Because, I mean, it's very, very important to remember that I only work on one cause of death. There are plenty of other causes of death, being hit by a truck or the planet being hit by an asteroid. And I'm not working on that. I'm very pleased that other people are working on them. But I don't think it's healthy to conflate death with aging. I think it's very important to distinguish the two in conversation and in discussion. Because, at the end of the day, if you talk about death and aging as if they were synonymous, then you're kind of talking about immortality, which is a different thing entirely. That's a religious thing, right? And it doesn't sound like technology anymore. And that's, that kind of trivializes it. And so to come back to directly answering your question, when I was a young kid, I was educated well in the sciences, and I understood the power of technology. And it was obvious to me that aging was the world's most important problem, that it causes the largest amount of suffering as well as the largest amount of death. And, therefore, someone ought to be working on it, really. But what I did not know at that time was that other people didn't think the same way. And it took me until my late 20s to discover that. What I actually did during my teens and early 20s is I went into a completely different field. I went into artificial intelligence research because I had found when I started trying it that I was a pretty good programmer. And I thought, well, okay, I will use that skill set to work on another of the world's most important problems, namely the problem of work, the fact that people have to spend so much of their time doing stuff that they would not do unless they were being paid for it. and that went pretty well. I was having a perfectly successful career in that space until I met and married a biologist who was a lot older than me. She was already a senior professor. And through her, I learned, first of all, a lot of biology, and also learned gradually that neither she nor the other people I was meeting through her were actually interested in aging. They were not working on aging. They did not see it this way at all. And I was just like completely bewildered by this. I still don't get it, really. how people who work in biology cannot think that way, can think that aging is not their problem. But that's a fact. That's how it was back in the 90s when I started in this field. And so I thought, well, okay, look, I mean, I'm working quite successfully in one field that's important for humanity, but this other field is even more important. And so I need to switch fields. And I happened to be in a position where I was able to do that without too much risk. And here I am.
I do like the way you say, look, I'm not about immortality. That does kind of somewhat trivialise it. I'm about extending health. And I think you're right. It's a much better way to kind of frame it. Look, let's talk a little bit about aging itself. I suppose immediately we think of things like the cellular and molecular level and cells aging. And I suppose what I mean when I say that is your genetics, you know, can play a lifespan, or the genes that you have, things turning on and off, things changing as you get older. Can you take us into that tiny world?
Yes. So let me see the best way to do that. Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. This is all, you know, the important work that needs to be done and that is being done is at the microscopic level, the molecular and cellular level. And what we're trying to do is to manipulate this very, very, very complicated machine called the human body to cause it to not get sick, not cease to function. Now, any machine, whether it's a complicated machine or whether it's a simple machine like a car, is set up to tolerate a certain amount of the damage that it inflicts upon itself as a side effect of its normal operation. And that's why a car will always work pretty well for the first 5 years or more, even if you don't take particularly good care of it. But it's also why a car does not work for 50 years, unless you take pretty good care of it, because it accumulates enough damage that, you know, the doors fall off and so on. And the human body, despite being living, whatever that means, and despite being vastly more complicated and vastly less well understood than a car, still is a machine, and the same applies. So what we are trying to do is to extend the time during which the body continues to work well, continues to work as well as it does in early adulthood, and I'm talking both physical function and mental function here, and to do that by whatever works. Now, different people have over the years had different approaches to this. One approach is to try to, if you like, make the body run more cleanly. In other words, damage itself more slowly than it normally would. And that's an approach that has had some limited success. But I think it's too limited. I believe that actually we can do much better by an alternative approach, which we can call preventative maintenance. And preventative maintenance is all about removing, eliminating, if you like, repairing the damage that the body is inflicting upon itself every so often, periodically, so that even though the damage is still occurring and still being generated, it does not reach a level of abundance that the body's not set up to tolerate. In other words, it doesn't reach the point where we get sick. At the moment, that philosophy, which essentially the main thing I'm known for really is that I was the one who pioneered that philosophy 25 years ago or so, that philosophy is definitely doing well. We are still some way from being able to make it really work. And a large part of why we're still some way from it is because it is inherently a divide and conquer strategy. You've got to fix a lot of different types of damage in the same way that you have to fix a bunch of different types of damage even in a car. It's far larger number in a human being, of course. And so, you know, some of those things are harder to fix than others. But we're getting there. The alternative approach of making the body run more cleanly is more unitary, if you like. You can do individual, single things that kind of trigger responses in the body that kind of do everything all at the same time. But the downside is that they only do it to a certain rather limited extent. So both of these approaches have their merits and demerits in terms of, you know, whether you want to get results now or whether you want to get really good results in the longer term. And that's why it's very valuable that there are people working, researchers like myself, working on one side, and researchers like David Sinclair, for example, working on the other side.
Yes, our own David Sinclair from the University of New South Wales. When you say run more cleanly, do you mean diet, exercise, stress management, the things that we perhaps already know?
Well, what I meant was the outcome. In other words, the creation of damage, the creation of these molecular and cellular changes to the structure and composition of the body that eventually accumulate to a point that makes us sick. Now, what you just mentioned is the ways in which we might do that. And yes, absolutely. Diet, you know, for example, it's been found that reducing your calorie intake makes a bit of a difference. It makes a big difference to short-lived animals. It makes a small difference to long-lived animals like you and me, but still some difference. Certainly exercise, certainly, you know, things like stress management, absolutely, of all kinds. You know, whether it's meditation, whether it's yoga, you know, all of the things that people talk about. Sleep, absolutely, it makes a huge difference because, you know, it's a big part of how the body has been set up to survive. So, yeah, all of those things. But, you know, there's a reason why nobody has lived beyond the age of 122, ever. The reason is simply that these things only have a limited benefit. So, you know, if you do things right, then you might live to 100. If you do things really right, you might live a little longer. Of course, different people have been dealt different decks of cards in terms of their genetics, which also makes a significant difference. So, you know, there's lots of different things that are feeding into this variation that we see in how long people live and indeed how long people stay healthy. But in order to transcend all of that and have people stay healthy for a lot longer, we will absolutely need to repair damage, not just to slow down the creation of damage.
So it's so interesting, the delineation you're making. So when you say Dr. Sinclair from UNSW and that his approach differs slightly from yours, maybe you could just quickly tell us what he's doing and this enzyme SIRT1 and the phenomena of this drugs like metformin, which diabetics have been taking, and what they've found is it has actually extended their life.
All right, so I'll get on to metformin at the end because David doesn't work on metformin. But David and I, you know, we have, you know, been very prominent leaders in this field for 20 years. We've been good friends for 20 years. We do have, you know, as I say, different emphases when it comes to what we actually do in our research, but we very much recognize the complementarity between the two. So what David does, and of course I only want to speak for him to a very limited superficial degree, what David does is he's interested in enhancing and, well, if you like, emulating the impact that we have on healthy lifespan and total lifespan by reducing the number of calories, the amount of calories that we take in. It was found a century ago that if you feed mice or rats a fair bit less than they would like, then they live longer, quite a lot longer, like 30 or 40% longer than they otherwise would, which is, you know, pretty cool. And it's been a very, very reproduced and well-studied phenomenon. But of course, people like eating. So there has always been an idea that maybe it would be great if we could somehow develop drugs that would trick the body into thinking that it's getting you know, fewer calories than it actually is, and responding metabolically in the same way, and thereby, you know, postponing aging by proxy, if you like. And David was one of the first people to develop ways to do that. He was working originally in yeast, in just single-cell fungal organisms. And, you know, that was very, very groundbreaking, important work. And over the years, he's obviously moved on and broadened that. Much of his main focus now is on a particular molecule called NAD, which is an extremely central molecule to the way the body works, to our metabolism. And if you manipulate it a bit in certain ways, then you can indeed trick the body into thinking that it's getting fewer calories than it actually is. There are a number of other things that David also has pioneered and talked about to do with maintenance of the genome. You know, so, you know, David's done, you know, a wide range of really important things over the years, and it's a delight to be, you know, shoulder to shoulder with him in this field, leading it forward.
Talk to us then a little bit about your research with the foundation.
Sure. So I've led a sequence of three foundations over the past 20 years, but all of them have been focused on essentially this same thing, this damage repair approach, as opposed to damage preemption. And it's gone pretty well. Essentially, I came up with this concept in the year 2000 and fleshed it out pretty quickly to the point of understanding the kind of categories of damage that we had to address. And that classification that I came up with back in 2000, 2001 has, I'm delighted to say, very much stood the test of time. We haven't had to adapt and extend it. And over the years, it's become more and more recognized as a very valid approach to keeping people healthier for longer than they otherwise would be. So that's great. But then we have to ask, you know, how do we actually implement this? And as I mentioned a moment ago, it's very much a divide and conquer approach, because the body, being a very complicated machine, generates, you know, it does itself a lot of different types of damage. So our work and my work and the people, the works of the teams that I've led have been transitioned over time as progress has been made. Initially, I looked at the field and I said, well, okay, there are all these types of damage that need to be fixed. Some of them are inherently easier to fix than others. And lo and behold, the ones that are easier are the ones that other people are already working to fix. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get myself into a position to fix the more difficult ones. And in order to do that, one has to essentially work outside of the standard academic system. The reason one has to do so is because there's not nearly enough money in the standard academic system. And you have to write grants which get reviewed by other scientists, and they decide whether to give you any money to do the work you want to do. And the result is basically one is forced, if one is in the standard in academia, to be very, very short-termist and fashionable. And one can't do the harder and less fashionable things at all. So I escaped that by setting up a foundation that was independent and that was completely funded by philanthropy. So I only had to convince individuals. I didn't have to convince governments or, you know, anyone who had to cover their
universities and so on, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the result was, over the years, I have been able to get a lot done that would never have been done by anybody else, and I'm very pleased about that. But the current situation that's existed over the past few years and is the main focus of my current organization, LEV Foundation, is the next step that is inherently necessary for any divide and conquer approach to anything. You know, the first step is develop the components, you know, and the second step is put them together. And putting them together is easier said than done for a system like the human body that we understand so poorly, because you may encounter, you know, unanticipated antagonistic interactions between the things that you want to combine. So what we're doing right now at LEV Foundation is addressing exactly that. At the moment, we have a very large experiment with 1,000 mice going on in upstate New York in the US, which is combining four of the most classical interventions in gerontology, ones that have already been individually demonstrated to confer some increase in healthy lifespan and total lifespan in mice, and specifically to do so by damage repair, or when you are starting, when the mice are already in middle age, like two-thirds of the way through their normal lifespan. So this is not a lifelong intervention that would be irrelevant to those of us who have the misfortune to be already 61, like me. This is, you know, this is something that can be applied to people who actually care about aging. And so we are pretty happy with how it's going. This experiment started something over a year ago, a year and a quarter ago. It'll be going for a little while yet, but it's not the only one we want to do. We want to do lots of experiments like this. We believe the time has come when these are the most important, the most high priority experiments to do in terms of, you know, the amount of information learned per dollar spent.
It does
These experiments are very expensive, but they are worth it.
It does sound fascinating. By the way, you're listening to ABC Overnights. My guest is Dr. Aubrey de Grey. He is a biomedical gerontologist, and he's trying to find the elixir of youth. He's trying to extend health for as long as possible. He reckons that you might even be able to get to 1,000, which is pretty old. The four things that you're testing on the mice, what are they, the 1,000 mice?
So one of them is a drug that tricks the body into thinking it's not getting enough calories, what's technically called a calorie restriction mimetic. And it's actually not one of the ones that David works on. It's another one that's also done very well called rapamycin. The other three are all bona fide damage repair in one way or another. So we are giving gene therapy to make more telomerase. This is an enzyme that's had a lot of airtime over the years in the field. And it seems to be good for mice. One other thing we're doing is we're giving them young blood, not young actual blood, but young blood stem cells. So again, this is another thing that's been quite high profile over the past 10 or 15 years, that if you transfuse mice, or indeed humans now, with young blood or with some component of some subset of the blood, then it seems to be beneficial. We are doing, again, one of those. We are doing a bone marrow transplant with young bone marrow. And then the final thing we're doing is we're giving these mice something called a senolytic, which is a drug that removes cells that have become kind of zombie cells, cells that are not doing what they ought to be doing in the body, and they are actively poisoning the body. Some years ago, it was discovered that one could kill off these cells using certain carefully designed small molecules, and we're using one of those.
And how are they going, those 1,000 mice in upstate New York?
Well, it's pretty good. I mean, one of the great things about running an independent nonprofit that is funded purely by philanthropy is that we can talk about the work we're doing while it is still going on. We don't have to worry about, you know, publication priority and intellectual property and so on. And so I'm putting out updates every month on our website and on social media. And yes, we're very happy about how it's going. Certainly the mice that are getting all four of these things are doing a lot better than the mice that are getting none of them. We also have treatment groups that are getting into just one out of the four or three out of the four to, you know, to be able to identify more information. But yeah, we're extremely happy about how the whole thing's going.
Yeah, it does sound really exciting. Just before you go, I know that you've got to go in a second. And it's been great to talk to you. There are a few, of course, diseases that we do conflate with aging. Perhaps I can use that term. And I mean things like Alzheimer's and cancer, which seem to be things that people get towards the end of their lives. A doctor once said to me that basically when you die, as you know, in your 80s, it's inevitable that you'll be carrying some kind of cancer somewhere. It's just one of those things. Is this how are we on that front?
Thank you for asking that question, because it's a really important one. Actually, this conflation that you just said is the right thing to do. It is wrong to make a distinction between the diseases of old age and aging itself. There is no such distinction. The distinction is purely semantic. There are aspects of aging like Alzheimer's and cancer that we have chosen to give disease-like names to, but they are aspects of aging. So the work that people like myself, or indeed David, are doing is absolutely addressing all of the so-called diseases of aging at the same time as addressing so-called aging itself.
Look, it's a fascinating area. I think we've only got time for one more quick question, and that simply would be this. What's your advice to people? I know that you've talked about, you know, blood transfusion, stem cells. Some of that stuff would be things you probably can't do at home. Have you got some advice for people in terms of things that they can do maybe tomorrow when they jump into their Saturday to increase their life or to give themselves a healthy head start?
I don't really have anything to say over and above do what your mother told you. You know, don't smoke, don't get seriously
apple a day,
and all that.
Yeah.
However, I will say this. Australia has a few things going for it. Number one is, from the regulatory perspective, Australia is particularly favorable for early stage clinical trials. And a number of the most important clinical trials in regenerative medicine have been done in Australia before they were done anywhere else. So if you're the kind of person who'd like to get involved in an early stage trial, maybe help yourself, maybe help humanity, then Australia's the right place to be. That's a very important thing to bear in mind. Another thing is, there's a lot of Australian researchers who've done really good work. David is by no means the only one. And there's a lot going on there that is very important. So supporting that is, educate yourself about what's going on in your country and maybe find a way to help it, whether it's financially, whether it's doing what you're doing right now, interviewing someone, an expert in the community. You know, there's a lot that can be done. So I feel that the right attitude for anyone in the general public, whatever their skill sets, whatever their resources, is to look not only at the immediate term about what can be done today, but to look at how one can invest in the future, both one's own future and the future of humanity.
Well, it's amazing to talk to you. I did want to ask you if you were kind of doing yourself out of a job. If you succeed, will there be no gerontologists left?
That's the problem I'd like to have.
Yeah, that's right. Or would every doctor become a gerontologist because everyone's so old? But lovely to talk to you and appreciate you giving us some time from the US this morning.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.